This podcast is not meant to be professional advice of any kind. It is meant to be informative and entertaining. If you make any changes to your life, see the appropriate professional before you do so. What kind of super ager are you? Go to ageist.com/quiz, take the super ager quiz, and we'll send you directed, personalized information to help you super age the best that you can. Welcome to Super Age. My name is David Stewart. I am the founder of Ageist and your host on the Super Age show. We talk about how to live healthier, how to live longer, and how to be happier. And who doesn't want that? Today's show is brought to you by Inside Tracker, the dashboard to your inner health. Go to insidetracker.com/ageist. Save 20% on all their products. Today's show is sponsored by Fatty 15. Fatty 15 features the first essential fatty acid to be discovered in 90 years, and is on a mission to restore your long-term health. Go to fatty15.com/ageist. Use the code ageist at checkout for 15% off their 90-day subscription starter kit. This show is also brought to you by Element, L-M-N-T, my favorite electrolyte mix. It's what I put in my water in the morning, and it's what I put in my water at the gym. Go to drinkelement.com/ageist and receive a free 8-serving sample pack with any purchase. Welcome to episode 176 of the Super Age Podcast. We'll be dropping this on March the 20th, 2024. 176 reminds me that I graduated from high school in, 1976. Do you remember what things were like in 1976? Do you remember what the cars were? Oh my God, it was like peak ugly. Ugh, it's like high school miscreants. We were drinking things like Boone's Farm, Strawberry Hill. Ugh, oh my God, how did any of us survive that time? Anyway, here we are today, and I'm happy to be here. This week on the show, we have adventurer and author Carolyn Paul, and we're going to talk about the value of awe, which I think is a really underappreciated value in our modern society. Carolyn has a new book out called Tough Broad, From Boogie Boarding to Wing Walking, How Outdoor Adventure Improves Our Lives as We Age. 100% I am on board with that. Fascinating conversation. Stay tuned for that. We oftentimes record these podcasts pretty much in the week that we drop them, but this week it's being recorded a week earlier because our staff member, who normally takes care of this stuff, is going on, yes, an adventure, as he often does. And I think this next week he's going somewhere in Colorado for like a week, I think with his friends in places where there's no cell phone or electricity, living in a tent. I don't know. I just love following his adventures. Like, there was the time he's like, I'm going to the North Shore of Hawaii. I'm going to harvest pineapples. I'm like, okay, cool. I just want to say that it's very common for people my age and my generation, I don't even like saying that, to, you know, slam people that are younger, particularly people in their teens and 20s. But I just think they're fantastic. It's such joy to work with these younger people. I sound so old when I say that. I don't mean to. It's just a really different thing. Back when I was that age, you know, talking about your feelings or aspirations for adventure or things like that in a work environment was just like, absolutely no, go. And it's quite common today. And I really enjoy having these sort of folks work here. They know a lot more about a lot of things that I don't. I know some things that they don't, so that's nice. I find that this openness, the accessibility that they bring to things, they're, you know, bringing their sort of internal worlds to work life, I think is really refreshing. And I love that they, you know, there are a few of these sort of folks that work here, and they do things like this. It's like, oh yeah, you know, like, just heads up. Next month, I'm going to be living in my van and I'm traveling around the southern U.S. I'll be available. You know, I'm online all the time. It's like, okay, that's cool. You know, let me know how that goes. Bring back stories to the rest of us. So here's a big plug for those sort of people. I guess, is that Gen Z people in their early 20s? I don't know. I can't keep track of this. What happens after Gen Z? Do we like recycle back to Gen A? I don't know. Has anybody figured that out? Anyway, we're going to get with the very entertaining and really super ballsy OG author Carolyn Paul in just a moment. Inside Tracker, the dashboard to your inner health. I've been using Inside Tracker for over 3 years now. I've been able to reduce my inner age from my chronological age of 65 to an inner age now of 56. I did this gradually over time following their recommendations.
Because not only with Inside Tracker do I have a dashboard to my inner health, knowing what's going on inside me, I also have a roadmap on how to improve that. Their food first, supplement second recommendations have helped me tremendously. I recommend everyone get a dashboard to their inner health. Go to insidetracker.com/ageist. Save 20% on all their products.
Today's episode is also brought to you by Fatty 15. The story here is that Fatty 15 co-founder Dr. Stephanie Venn Watson discovered C15 while working with the U.S. Navy to improve the health and welfare of aging dolphins. Now, her discovery marks the first essential fatty acid to be found in over 90 years. C15 is known to work in a few ways. It repairs age-related damage to our cells. It protects our cells from future breakdown, boosts mitochondrial energy output, and activates those pathways in the body that help regulate things like sleep and mood. Now, Fatty 15 is on a mission to replenish your C15 levels and restore your long-term health. You can get an additional 15% off their 90-day subscription starter kit by going to fatty15.com/ageist and using the code ageist at checkout.
Just a quick heads up, as always, after my conversation with Carolyn Paul, we're going to just try this, that little tidbit to help you live a little happier, a little longer, and maybe a little healthier. But let's give Carolyn Paul a call right now. You're going to love this. Caroline, wonderful to see you today. Where does this podcast find you today?
I'm at home in San Francisco.
Very nice. So you have a book out called Tough Broad, From Boogie Boarding to Wing Walking, How Outdoor Adventure Improves Our Lives as We Age. That's a lot of words, but I love the title.
You're my target audience, but you are also my target audience.
Thank you. We're going to get into that. I want to learn about your background. Where do you come from and what brought you to write a book like this?
Well, in general, my background is that I've always been an outdoors person, mostly because I think I had one of those free range childhoods that we had in the 60s. I'm 60 now. I'm 60, almost 61. So I grew up in the 60s and 70s when our parents just put us on a bike and said, come back at dark. And so that's where I think my whole outdoor affinity started. And, you know, I was a whitewater rafter. I was a stand-up paddleboard. I surf. None of it very well, but I fly. I fly a lot of different experimental aircraft. I'm not an expert, but I am a jack of all trades in the outdoors, I think. And when I was about 55, I started looking around and seeing that there was no women my age doing what I was doing, which is basically nothing super rad. Just I was surfing. I was on an electric skateboard. I was maybe paddleboarding under the Golden Gate Bridge. And I see men my age and older, but no women. And I started to wonder, as 60 was glowing on the horizon, like, what is my future like? Am I going to have to give up outdoor adventure? And so that kind of began my quest. This book started with a question, like, is outdoor adventure good for me as I age? And I went from there.
Is it?
Yes. Well, you know, it was funny. I started the book right before the pandemic and I set up all these interviews. And then, of course, nobody wanted to talk to me because, you know, we were all isolated in our homes. So I ended up doing a lot of research first, which turned out to be perfect because I really started to understand all the facets of fulfilling aging. And I started to get a sense, and I had a sense that outdoor adventure was good for us, but I didn't really know why. And when I started the interviews, I was much more prepared because I understood what the four or really five important pillars of fulfilling aging were.
And those are?
A couple of them are pretty obvious. It's community, which tends to fall away as we age. Novelty, so new things to keep our brain active and our emotional well-being really perked up. Purpose, another thing that gets very difficult as we age, especially for women. And what was the other one? Not community, purpose, not health, obviously, physical health and emotional health. And outdoor adventure just seemed to encompass all those at once. With almost any activity you go out and do, you're touching all those foundational elements. And the one I think where outdoor adventure is really key for women is the final pillar, which is a positive mindset about your own aging, which so many of us don't have as women because the messaging is so difficult and, you know, basically doomsayer-ish about our own aging.
Oh, I agree. 100%. Going back to the 80s, like, you know, fight the power. Don't believe the hype. Like, this is why we started ageist. Like, exactly right. That. Yeah. That whole infantilizing, like, be scared, be very scared. This is really horrible. Well, okay. I don't think so.
Well, but that messaging, I think, you know, David, I wanted to write a book in general for all of us aging, but I was really clear that the messages that men and women get are very different as we age. Mm-hmm. I mean, you still have Harrison Ford, who's running through, you know, the Indiana Jones tombs at 75. And we don't get those kind of role models. Not really. And, you know, on all fronts, on the dating apps, in the media, the message is either we're not there or our aging is going to be full of, you know, breaking bones and cognitive decline and basically irrelevance. I had a lot of women say they felt irrelevant as they age, as children moved out of the house, their our looks are changing, all the values, our currency was changing. Mm-hmm. And I think we could adapt individually, but the culture was saying we're not interested. And so I think that really, it does really affect the way we age. And when I was doing research, I found, and you probably already know this, that there is substantial research on the fact that the way we look at our aging predicts how well we will age. So if you have a negative view on aging, you have a much higher chance of cardiac arrest earlier, of cognitive decline earlier. And the opposite's true. If you have a positive view about your own aging, you are going to be healthier and happier as you age, and you'll live longer. But then that begged the question for me, like, okay, that's good, but how do you get that positive mindset?
You need a better community. I mean, I can tell you, I mean, it sounds really simplistic, but I live in Park City, Utah. So I ski race. I'm part of the Masters ski racing program. I'm 65. I'm a guy. I'm fairly sporty. I'm going to say easily half of that program is women. They're mostly 60 to 70. They're way better than I am. Way better than I am. Like in my town, somebody asks you to go for a hike. You need to level set and ask them, do they have a medal? Because you don't. And I think it's really like we get our messages. Yeah, there's all the media crap. We tend to level set to whoever we're around. And
agree. But your community is definitely not of the norm because
true.
I too have a pretty robust female community of women who are still outdoorsy, and they really do bolster me. But I feel like I'm not maybe as immersed because I live in a city as you are in this sort of outdoorsy atmosphere. But I was lucky enough to have my own subliminal messages from my own mom, who really blossomed after she was 40 and 50 and then 60, she picked up bicycling, and that really just changed the way she thought of herself, of what she could do and what she couldn't do. And then people's reactions to her bike adventures were such that it became this virtuous cycle. And I'm watching all this. And to me, aging looks pretty great. And because again, I'm getting this pretty constant messaging, but it has to be constant because I think the pervasiveness of the negative messaging is everywhere, from the young people around us to our own ingrained beliefs from when we were young and looked at older people. So again, like, yes, I need to come to Park City and hang out with the tough dudes there and the tough dudes there. I think that just really is a testament to what I'm trying to say in the book, which is outdoor adventure is key to fulfilling aging.
100%. Sometimes I go over to Little Cottonwood and I ski at Alta, and I'm 65 and one of the young people, and I'm like not anywhere near the skill level of these people. They do things that, like, I wouldn't dream of doing. And it's just normal. And listening to this, I'm on board 100% with what you're talking about. And we're going to get into, like,
I don't have to convince you.
Well, I think that in terms of solution, which is what people are like, well, how do I do that? Like, everybody around me is, you know, they're pre-diabetic, they got metabolic syndrome, they can't get on the sofa. Okay, fine. There's this awesome thing. It's called digital. And I'm sort of a big believer in seeking out digital blue zones, that there are digital communities of people that can you know, support you and participate in these things. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, it was interesting because I just assumed, because I was talking to older women, that they would not be, you know, technologically inclined or think of getting in touch with their outdoor selves through the computer. But in fact, quite a few of them used meetups. One woman who I interviewed who had lost her husband, and I was interviewing her because I was interested in grief and loss, which is an inevitable part, of course, life itself, but it is something that seems to become more acute as we age. So I wanted to talk to her about how she used the outdoors to as an antidote to that. Yeah. And she and I went sea kayaking, and she had just lost her husband, 8 months before, and I was in his kayak. But one of the things she said is that she really had to redefine herself after losing a partner who also did a lot of the outdoor sort of work. When they took their RV to go on camping trips, he would do, all the RV stuff, and she would cook. And now she, if she wanted to do that, would have to learn how to do the RV, learn how to dump the sewage, and learn how to like map it out. And it's not like she wasn't an independent person in general, but this was difficult. And it was a sort of admitting that her husband was no longer there too. So she would just go on the internet. She learned how to dump her RV sewage from the internet. She went on meetup sites to see if she could find women to hike with. And I interviewed a woman named Cynthia Hicks, who at 71 was routinely typing in when she traveled. She'd do little road trips, and she would type in something fun to do here. And things would pop up, and she would look further, and that's how she went wing walking, for instance, and therefore I went wing walking. So there's a lot of the women I spoke to did use the internet.
I will say that your gender has a distinct advantage here, that your gender, unlike my gender, which is like really socially handicapped, you're able to say things like, I'm new here, could you help me out? Or say yes to an invite, whereas the men harder.
I don't know. Yes. But then there's all that messaging that says, oh, don't do that. It's too dangerous. Yeah. You hurt yourself. And I think men power past that in ways that I really very much admire. I mean, I'd be in really cold winter swell in up here in Northern California and look around, and there'd be men much older than me, but no women. So, but I do want to say, before we get too deep in this, that one of the things I learned, this book was a quest. Unlike my other books where I pretty much wrote it as a statement for 250 pages, this was questions. I was asking other people questions and really didn't know the answer. And so as it unfolded, I began to change my whole definition of adventure. I was somebody who enjoyed, inflating a paraglider and stepping off a cliff for many years, or taking a sea kayak for weeks and weeks on the ocean on an expedition through places no one else had been in a sea kayak before. So when I, for instance, went bird watching, I have to say that initially I was like, I'm only doing this because it seems like a really good way to get outside for people, and getting outside is important, but I don't know if I'd call it an adventure. And then when I went bird watching, and here we were on a quest, we were feeling exhilarated. We were definitely physically vital. I walked 6 miles. I was with Virginia Rose, who had started a nonprofit, called Birdability, that tries to get people with disabilities outside bird watching. And so they wheeled 6 miles. I was a walking person, so I walked. So there's a physical vitality. And then, of course, there's always the uncertainty of what's going to happen outside. Is the weather going to turn? Are we going to get lost? So there's that novelty that happens with adventure, that uncertainty. I realized it had all the rhythms of an adventure. And so one of the things that this book is it covers a lot of different outdoor activities and looks at how those slot into, as an antidote, again, to many of our concerns about aging.
Talk to me about adventure and risk. So let's talk about risk. You mentioned what adventure is. Talk to me about risk.
Well, risk, it's kind of a loaded word when people look at me and ask me about risk, because again, I have lived my life as somebody who has, I'd say, enjoyed risk. I was a firefighter for many years here in San Francisco. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so when there was a fire, I would always be psyched. And people would look at me, civilians, like, what? You're psyched about a fire? I mean, how could that be? And no, I'm not psyched that there is a fire. But if there's going to be a fire, I definitely wanted to be there. I mean, so my tolerance for risk is pretty high. And I feel like risk might be the wrong word because it has so many connotations. I really want people to push their boundaries. Mm-hmm. So maybe that is risky for them and risky for me, but I think there's pushing your boundaries is really key for a lot of reasons. It makes you look inside yourself, and it offers those of us who, you know, are starting to worry about maybe their memory, as we are told to do as we age, it offers novelty. Risk, because you have to make all these decisions. I mean, it's a really invigorating place to be, right outside your comfort zone. And that's the great thing about going outside, is it's always kind of pushing your comfort zone.
It's neurogenerative, right? So you're doing two things. You're using your body. So the best way to ward off any kind of, you know, age-related brain dysfunction is use your body in some way, because the main thing your brain does is take care of your body, control that.
Yep.
And then you're, you know, the novel stimulus, which is what's so interesting about, you know, being outside, like you said, you never know. It's always something new, and it's a full sensory experience. It's the sound, it's the smell, it's the touch, it's like all these things. So yeah, 100%. The reason I want to bring up the word risk is sort of the anti-side of comfort. And one of the things that I find really difficult is people get a little old, like I'm 65. So I have been trained to sit in the softest chair, to go business class, go for like everything. We want like more comfort, comfort, comfort. Okay. But if you're constantly aiming for comfort, you're just going to be in decay. You're going to be in decline, right? So we need this sort of challenge to ourselves, be that physically, mentally, and emotionally too, to challenge ourselves. Otherwise, there's this inertia that's pressing in on us all the time. And so many times I hear people say, well, that's kind of uncomfortable. I don't know if I want to do that. Like, you know, even like simple stuff, like the cold plunge. Oh gosh, I can't do that. That would be uncomfortable. Or, you know, let alone going in a couple of weeks in a sea kayak.
It's funny. I feel like if a doctor told people, go in that cold plunge, you know, it'll do just what this pill does, or it's the pill I'm giving you. Go in this. People will do it. They'll do it without even questioning it. I mean, we sit there and take pills that have terrible side effects. And it's hugely uncomfortable to be physically unhealthy. It's hugely uncomfortable to be mentally anxious or depressed. And going outside, you know, they did this study on 400,000 Scandinavian cross-country skiers of older, I think they were over 60. I think they were 60 to 90. And they had statistically significant lower rates of anxiety than the average. And now the scientists said that was because they were exercising. I posit you forgot one key thing. They're outside.
Yeah.
It's more than exercising. They're feeling physically vital. And I think that's a subtle difference, but it's key because it allows for our emotional well-being, our physical well-being. And I mean, it really, for women especially, when you confront that vitality and go past it, that upends a lot of what you've been told about what you can do at this age. And I remember, I went and to San Diego to hang out with these boogie boarders. They were made up of like 60, 70, 80, and even a 90-year-old, 97. She was actually 97, but she was waiting for warmer water, she told me that day. And one of the women who I spoke to, she had never had an outdoor lifestyle. And she was simply walking on the beach with her dog, I think, which I guess could be considered outdoorsy. She didn't consider herself outdoorsy. I consider a walk on the beach outdoorsy, but she just didn't have an affinity to the ocean, anything like that. But she happened to see these women. It was during the pandemic, and she happened to see these women in the waves, and they looked like they were having so much fun. And she decided she would try it. And she was immediately hooked. And when I asked her, like, why do you love it so much? She kind of didn't have initially the words, because sometimes we're often not asked these deeper feelings, but she kind of like looked and said, look, the Pacific Ocean, it's so, and what she was saying was, here I am, and look at the Pacific Ocean, and I'm in it. And that vitality, that physicality changed how she thought of herself. She said that she'd become more social. She started trying new things. She'd been afraid of heights. She decided she would go on this hike where there was sheer cliff on one side. And she kind of told me a little shyly, like I know, or sheepishly almost, I know that's not a big deal for some people, but for her, it was huge. And when she did that trek, again, a new like opening up. So that kind of, but I would call it an exploration mindset as opposed to like a risk, just because I think it's because of my own evolution that I was definitely somebody who just loved risk, loved everything I almost had to die, really. And it's, you know, I used to be a whitewater rafter who did first descents with a team of women around the world. We did rivers that hadn't been done before. And that kind of thing, I mean, it's cool to do, to be first at things. When I was a firefighter, I always wanted to be the first into the fire. That was the place that all of us wanted to be. It was the kind of place with the most unknown and the most risk, because it was uncertain. If you're the second person, well, that person ahead of you is checking things out, even if they're just a couple inches ahead of you crawling in the dark. But nowadays, that doesn't interest me that much. That's not why I do outdoor adventure. That's probably why I'm shying away from that word risk and inviting more like exploration and pushing comfort zones.
I like this idea of exploring the boundaries of who we think we are. And I think that, you know, what you're saying about self-image, I tell people our greatest limitation is our imagination of what's possible. And that's really all about how we see ourselves. I once had a mental health professional in a non-professional setting tell me we have three fundamental core delusions about ourselves. They're fundamental, they're core, and they're delusions. And so it's just like we're blinded by these things.
What are those three delusions?
I mean, we each have our own.
Oh,
so
get right about that.
No, it's terrible. So the only way that you have any insight to these is someone has to tell you, no, that's not true. Or the other way is like the self-educational variety, which is what you're talking about, exploring the boundaries. So if, you know, how should I say this? So if somebody goes out and they go surfing for the first time and they come back and they're like, I did that. This runs counter to what I thought I was. That turns out not to be true. I'm this other thing. And then the door starts to open. It's like, what else do I think about myself that's not true that maybe I can do? And I think it builds and builds. And I'm a huge supporter of what you're talking about here. Good for me. Yeah,
no, I hear that. I think what maybe what I'm thinking is that those realizations can come without sort of an extreme risk element. I wrote a whole book called The Gutsy Girl that encouraged parents to allow their girls to access bravery, because I felt like it was such a big learning tool.
Yeah.
Instead of accessing fear, which is what we're always encouraging girls to be, which is scared. We should do the flip side and encourage bravery. And the way you do that, obviously, is to go into situations where you are scared. But I think even, for instance, when going on a walk outside and, you know, feeling that the weather change, like I said, or you have to get up early, or all these small boundaries that you're pushing that you don't even kind of realize, because it's all kind of under the guise of, well, in the case of Lorraine and boogie boarding, it was under the guise of fun. She just, it was the pandemic. She probably was a little stir crazy, and these women look like they're having fun. And then suddenly she finds all these other elements. I think it was a little bit like when we were kids, my parents encouraged us to do a wide range of activities, biking, sledding, ice skating, swimming, but not because they wanted us to have, you know, build up our character and our bravery and our, you know, ability to make decisions, decision making and risk assessment. None of that. That language wasn't even there. That's or our resilience. Like none that might be going on now when parents, you know, want their kids to go out and do certain things. But back then it was simply to be kind of a well-rounded person. So I think we entered into our adventures without, you know, realizing a lot of the lessons we were learning. And it's the same now. So when Lorraine goes in the water to have fun and then realizes that big wave just pushed a boundary and now she feels like she can do even bigger waves, like that's just a gift.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of talk about sort of the difference between the way we grew up and the way kids grow up now. It's just a different world. And yeah, like you, I'm not convinced they were really that interested in us growing as people. They just wanted us out of the house. And we were a bother. So here's your peanut butter and jelly sandwich. See you at 7 o'clock tonight. You know, try not to die. And that was it. And, you know, we did get hurt. You know, we did risky stuff. And it's just different today now. And I think it's really fair to compare to younger people today. It's a different world.
But I mean, those kids then are us now. And I am seeing women, you know, pulling back and not engaging in play. I mean, I think play is really important as adults for our holistically emotional and mental well-being.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, pickleball is like huge. And
I've never played, but I'm like,
I just think it's
around outside having fun.
Yeah, there's something about the whole thing that I have a little like image problem with, but that people do it. I think this is fantastic. I mentioned earlier, I do this like ski racing thing. So a lot of times I'm on the mountain every day. And the thing about being on the mountain every day is you see things that you just don't see unless you're there every day. Like you see how things change, you know, the snow changes, you see the different animals, like serious weather comes through. And it expands me, like what I can do, what I've seen versus, you know, I'm in an apartment in Manhattan now. Like it's pretty controlled here. There's not a whole lot going to go on. I want to agree with you. And I think that there is something about if you go out and you're going to go for a walk in the park or something and you say like, wow, it's raining. Well, okay. It's the modern time. It's Gore-Tex. You're fine.
It's a tiny adventure. I mean, I actually, you mentioned like the fact that you go skiing every day. And I was interested in both the practice of outdoor activity when somebody does it. So for instance, I interviewed someone who learned to swim later in life and she now swims every day, but she had no outdoor background. She enlisted a friend and went swimming. But I was also interested in that one time boundary pushing outdoor adventure.
Yeah.
So my own mom grew up with a mother who was very much somebody who cautioned her about doing anything outdoorsy. And she really never had an outdoors life. So even as she was throwing us into the outdoors, she or my dad, neither of them were adventurers of that ilk at all. But when she was 52 and she had just gone through sort of, I think, a difficult time with her boyfriend and had gone to LA and decided to go skydiving once, just take one skydiving. And she considered herself somebody who was not a brave person.
Right.
And she went skydiving and it was seismic. I mean, she just having done one thing that upended, disproved what she thought of herself, stuck with her. It wasn't just, so I was interested in looking at that as well. The practice is really important, but also taking up an opportunity that just, you know, jumps out in front of you. Well, that's actually why. So I went wing walking, as I said. And for those of you who don't know what wing walking is, it's from the old barnstorming days. We don't do it anymore. There's only one place in the United States that actually teaches this. But back in the old days, it was, you know, these people walking on the wings of biplanes for the crowds below. It's called barnstorming. But it faded once there were way too many accidents in those small little biplanes because they actually did do things like fly through barns. So when that faded, wing walking faded too, because if you couldn't do low level flight, you couldn't see people. So it wasn't fun to charge for tickets of. So anyway, wing walking faded, but there turns out I saw this video of this woman who was 71 years old, who had just gotten over cancer, who was, I watched her as she took off on a biplane and then clambered up at 3,000 feet onto the wing of the plane, attached herself with the king post, and she was smiling the whole time. And then the pilot proceeds to do a series of loops and barrel and hammerheads.
Oh, no.
So I called her up, Cynthia Hicks. And because, again, I wanted to see like this one time thing, because you don't really become an expert wing walker. You just do it once for the experience. And she said, yeah, Caroline, you wouldn't believe the courage that is gained when you first step up on that wing.
Yeah.
And I was like, Cynthia, this means I have to go do it, which I didn't want to do because, of course, it's something I would want to write about. But I couldn't really understand the how one would want to get out of a perfectly good cockpit, because as a pilot myself, that just seemed dumb. So I was a little bit reluctant, but I wanted to experience this. So I did. I went to Mason Wing Walking in Washington State and took the class. And at 3,000 feet, there I was, and the wing waggled, and I was to get up on the wing. And I knew I would do it because I have a long background in basically burying my fear and doing things, but I was not happy. I get up on the wing, I attach myself to it, and then the pilot starts to do the first loop. And
God, I can't even imagine this.
It was fantastic. I went from, why am I doing this for a dumb book? And to just something. I didn't know. My mind was blown. There's no comparison on earth, even for a pilot like me, for what was happening, doing, you know, being catapulted around the sky like that. So when I came back down on the ground, I did some research and I realized that what was so life-changing about that, and it was for me, because the realization was that for the past like 10 or 15 years, I hadn't actually been doing my adventures because I was a daredevil. I was doing my adventures because I wanted to experience awe, because that's what I experienced up on the plane, up on the wing of this plane, so obviously. Because when you're about to die like that, or you think you, your brain thinks you are, your neural path, your neural, you know, situation just goes haywire, and you're open to this concept called awe. And since the when I, by the time I handed the book in, there were a bunch of books on awe, but I had never known that this was an attribute, really. I mean, it's sort of associated with religion, but no, it's a field of study, and awe is a really, really important mindset that we need to have. And I found that you don't have to get up on a wing to experience awe, because they did studies here in San Francisco of people between the ages of 60 and 80. They took them on what they called awe walks. So outside, because one thing they did say about awe is that the outdoors often generates it, you know, big spaces, that feeling that we're small, that we're smaller, something's bigger than us. Those are all awe triggers. So they had them walk outside and simply look around with childlike wonder. That was the instruction. And then they had a control group who just kind of walked like they usually do, checking their phone, making mental to-do lists, whatever you do on a walk. There was a marked difference in the, not just the emotional well-being of the awe walkers, but also a lot of the markers, like the inflammatory markers, the physiology improved, their immune systems improved. And so what I realized from that one experience was that awe was really what I had been after, certainly as I was older, and that I was getting out of adventure. And that changed a lot. That was a big sort of moment for me in the book. And wow. awe, if it's this important, is available to all of us. So you don't have to, you know, be a base jumper. Like I interviewed a base jumper here. You don't have to go base jumping. You can go walking like I did with a 94-year-old who loved to stop at every leaf, who wanted to only walk on grass, which meant we were cutting across people's private property all the time. I was petrified, but she wanted, basically, neither of us knew it at the time because I hadn't wing walked yet, but what she was doing was going on all walks.
I really love this idea of seeking awe as like a mission. It's like, I want to seek awe. And I think that that's, and this is why I don't do hallucinogens. Well, I haven't done hallucinogenic drugs in a very long time, but I think that's maybe why people do that. I want to tell you a story. Maybe you have some insight on this. I had a couple of folks over for dinner in Park City in December, and they were both, one was a former U.S. Olympic downhiller, and the other was, she was on the Canadian, I don't think she won an Olympic medal, but like at that level, you know, certain kind of person, right? Yeah. Certain kind of person like does that sort of thing. And I was asking the woman who she shattered her ankle at one point in her career, and so she couldn't race anymore. And I said, well, you know, what do you miss about it? And she said, the silence. I really didn't know what she was talking about. I'd worked in my previous career, I'd been around a lot of sort of Red Bull characters, they're athletes, and I didn't really understand why they did what they did. And I, in fact, I stopped working for that company because it was just life-threatening. It was like, I can't be around these people. But then I had a moment.
You're a little boring when you're just constantly just going after this adrenaline high. It's just a little bit narrow and boring.
So I actually experienced this in my ski race thing. At Sun Valley, I did my first and only Super G, and Super G isn't as fast as downhill, but you're going pretty fast, you know? And I came down to the bottom and I had this huge smile on my face, like, A, I'm alive, which was not guaranteed at the top.
Right.
And I'd succeeded. I didn't, you know, miss a gate or something. And I realized what they meant by silence. Like there was nothing, there was no sound. Like that race was about 60 seconds and probably 50 seconds of it, there was nothing. I'm not thinking. I'm not hearing. There is nothing. There's total silence. And it was like, so maybe some of this isn't really about the adrenaline thing. It's about, like, I meditate. I do all this other stuff. I'd never experienced that before.
I wonder also if you were in flow, which is a state to talk a little bit about too, which... Of course, you know, the movement combined with the emotional well-being, it's not fully understood. I knew somebody a long time ago who wanted to harness flow or the zone, which is they're slightly different, flow and the zone, but they're essentially similar. I write about the difference in my book. I'm sorry, I can't quite remember it now, but that sort of almost out of body, but you're very embodied at the same time experience. So yeah. It's interesting because I interviewed a base jumper and she is definitely somebody who, well, she didn't start outdoor adventure until she was in her 40s. She's African American. So the outdoor industry has just never marketed its wares to people of color. The outdoors has been unwelcoming to women and also people of color for many reasons. And national parks weren't fully desegregated till 1964. So I was already born. I mean, it's kind of shocking, but understandable why people of color don't feel safe in the outdoors. But also, they're sort of told in a lot of ways that it's not for them. And that's changing, luckily. Well, she started her outdoor life late. And she did skydive. She and her husband were skydiving. And then, he bought her those lessons for her birthday. Because he wanted to do it. You know, that's what couples do, right? And she went along with it. And then she was hooked. But then they transitioned pretty quickly to base jumping, both of them, which is considered one of the most dangerous sports in the world. And I asked her, like, why didn't you just stick to skydiving? I mean, it seems so much the same. And she said, with base jumping, there's this silence. Just the same thing. But I think there is actually a silence that happens. No airplane. And there's that free fall moment before the chute and the wind.
Yeah.
And it's only a couple seconds, but it was the silence. That was moving to me. Just like what you're saying. We're more complicated creatures when we're out there in the wild.
There's some sort of Venn diagram between awe and this silence thing. I'm not smart enough to figure that out, but I think there's a relationship there.
I think so too. I think so. I think there must be. There's some, again, triggers for awe. And one of them is just vastness, like the sky often triggers awe feelings, as does the Grand Canyon, for instance. They did this great part of the study. It was almost an afterthought where they gave the awe walker participants that I was talking about earlier a cell phone and said, just take a selfie. during it. And so in the beginning, the selfies were all like photos of themselves. They were faces in the, just big faces. That's pretty much it. And as the walk progressed, it was a 2-month all walk, you know, study. Over that period of time, they noticed that the selfies changed. The face got smaller. The person was pulling the phone away and photographing more the stuff in the background. Oh. And it sort of mirrored what awe does, which is make us think of ourselves as small, but not in a bad way. Whereas a lot of our devices these days make us the center of everything, and awe flips that around. So one of the scientists said is that like the iPhone is an anti-awe device because it's a small screen. It's very concentrated. You're looking in it and, you know, people are taught selfies. You take up the whole screen and they saw that the smiles increased and the face got smaller in the photos.
Yeah. I think there's something here about, you know, sense of self. Like I always tell people, you're stronger than you think you are in like always, not just like your ability to pick stuff up. And I think that, you know, this where we're like the center of everything is a very fragile, not very strong position.
Right. Whereas, and stressful.
It's really hard. It's really hard to be the center of the universe. It's a lot of work. It's really troubling. No. But if you're out there and you're like, well, I'm just sort of part of all of this. I'm a small part of all this. There's, to me, there's a real strength to that.
Yeah. And it's, I think there's an openness. Like, I think you become more open. Well, I mean, here's one thing that I noticed that when I was looking into awe is that, you know, a lot of our self-care that we're told to do these days is really kind of self-inflicted. That's not, but self-oriented, like go get a massage, you know, treat yourself to this, go to therapy. But what one of the scientists said is actually like turning your focus away from yourself outward has been shown to be much better for your mental health. I mean, I'm not taking away from therapy or massages or anything, but I think it's worth saying that if we need to feel better focusing outward, nature, to volunteering somewhere.
Absolutely.
To, you know, helping people, you know, boogie boarding in the surf, like outward, as opposed to like, how do I look? How do I feel? What should I say next? You know, that can be, that's not as healthy. And the cool thing is as we age, there is this sort of, I don't give a, you know, freak about anything or less. I don't care. I care so much less. And for women, especially, that is a burden that is lifted for us. And, you know, David, that is often not just a sort of a result of our years of experience and realizing it's so much healthier to not care about what others think. That's partly hormonal. Like once we hit menopause and our caregiving hormones, you know, things change. It's not that we're not empathetic. Yeah. It's that we've kind of switched, first of all, our empathy probably more towards ourselves, but we still have connection and we still seek connection like, you know, humans need to. And of course we are good at because we have those chemicals that were, you know, surging through us in order to raise our kids and help our partners. But now it's just a different, it's when I went and learned to fly a gyrocopter, I was concerned that I was 57, like, hey, am I too old to learn this? Is my brain like, you know, calcified? And my instructor, who happened to be 55 and a woman, said, oh no. I mean, I've found that women of our age are actually better students because it's kind of me time now. You know, we have more time and we have more focus and we have humility, but we also are like, it's time for what we want to do now.
I'm just going to say a little bit on this.
Yeah, do it.
I get a lot
of... I love when men talk about menopause. Do it.
Well, I don't know much about menopause. What I do know is that women in this age group lead everything. And I get on stage and I'll say that. And there's sort of a little bit of a pushback because the history of sexism, but I can say, listen, the women are starting the organizations. They're starting the companies. They're leading everything. And the men are out to lunch. And I have asked a lot of people smarter than me about exactly, I spoke to, what was her name? Gloria Feynman. She was the head of Planned Parenthood for about 20 years.
Gloria Steinem?
No, not Gloria Steinem. She's the feminist. No, this was Gloria Feynman, I want to say. Mm-hmm. I'm terrible. But anyway, what she told me was, because I said, listen, help me understand this. Because, like, I mean, I get pushback. And I said, listen, the men are like a special needs disaster group. Like, they're just like, you know, the suicide rates, the loneliness rates, the life expectancy, everything. They just can't get it together. And the women are just awesome. And she said, the women have always been awesome. The men just pull back and give space. And I've also heard from physicians that I've had on this program exactly what you're saying. There's a hormonal component to this where that sort of caregiving, I don't want to sound bad, but like, I'm exactly how you described it.
Yeah.
Happens. And
no, I read a book called The Upgrade by Brizid. Her first last name is Brizendine. Well worth reading for anybody interested, because she posits that this stage, this kind of final stage for us, for you and me, is an upgrade from after menopause. It's an upgrade, mm-hmm. not what everybody thinks, a downgrade.
Yeah, that's right. Is there, I'm just going to tell you, we're going to title this, I never tell anybody this, but I'm going to tell you, we're going to title this episode Seeking Awe, because I just love that as like sort of a
great, great. Yeah.
We should all be seeking awe.
You know, and I want to say again that it is just a mindset. And it's just like adventure, what I was saying about adventure itself. And it's not the actual activity that matters. It's the emotions that it gives you specifically based on your life experience, your the moment in time you're in. That's what's important. You know, exhilaration, exploration, vitality, that's adventure. And also the same, you don't get on a wing. I completely support you if you don't get on a wing.
I'm not doing that. I'm just telling you, Caroline.
But you know, go. It's that childlike wonder.
Yeah.
You have to access.
Yeah, that's right. Caroline, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you for inspiring me. As I said, I'm not going wing walking. I have limits today. That's one of them.
Yes. A new permutation of skiing, maybe.
Well, it's just as you were talking, you know, my downhill buddies who don't do that anymore, they're really into like backcountry. So they put skins on their skis and they hike up to places where there aren't people and then they ski down. And there is a level of danger to that, but you're in a state of awe, essentially. Yes. That's why they do that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think adapting as we age, I mean, I have a whole chapter on adaptation. A lot of people can't leave behind like your skiers. I think one of your skiers was super deep and philosophical when she said silence, but I think maybe other skiers are like, you know, the speed, the adrenaline, the audience cheering me on. But when you can't have that anymore, is the solution just to give up skiing altogether? I mean, there's adaptations.
Right. That's right. That's right. It's not zero and one. There's like, yeah, we're clever, intelligent humans. We have brains. We can deal with spectrums.
Right. Exactly. We invented kiteboarding from sailing through windsurfing and surfing and boat. Like we're constantly morphing some little wooden board into something, you know, different and fun.
Caroline, it has been a delight. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was really fun.
That was really amazing. I mean, imagine, can you just imagine being strapped out on the wing of a biplane and it's doing loops and rolls 3,000 feet up in the air? It's sort of beyond my imagination. Anyway, you want to check out Carolyn Paul's book, Tough Broad, From Boogie Boarding to Wing Walking, How Outdoor Adventure Improves Our Lives as We Age. We're going to get with Just Try This, sort of on this theme, in just a moment after a quick word from our sponsors.
Did you know that just pounding water all day is not going to keep you hydrated? You need the right mix of electrolytes in that water to help that water be absorbed properly and also to help your body function well with the right electrolytes. Element, LMNT, contains sodium, potassium, and magnesium, which are critical for helping our brains and our bodies function. One of the unfortunate facts is as we get older, it's harder to drink water, essentially because our thirst response is diminished. So we need to put extra emphasis on drinking water, staying hydrated with the right electrolytes. Of course, if you are pre-hypertensive or have hypertension, check with your doctor before having anything with sodium in it. For the rest of us, though, Element is a great solution. Go to drinkelement.com. That's D-R-I-N-K LMNT.com/ageist. Get a free 8-serving sample pack with your first purchase.
This week on Just Try This, I am not going to suggest that we jump out of airplanes or get strapped to an airplane doing barrel rolls. Oh my God, this is like beyond me. But I do love this sense of awe. I think it's really important for our, can I use the word spirit, for our inner spirit to have this sense of awe somewhat regularly. I think it's really refreshing. I think it's tied to the idea of novelty. I think it's tied to neuroplasticity. And I think it's tied to the sense of just feeling vividly alive. So how can we get the sense of awe? I was once on the top of a non-functioning extinct volcano on the island of Maui. And I watched sunrise there, which I believe it was Mark Twain said was the most sublime experience of his life. I don't know if I would go that far, but it was pretty good. Definitely a sense of awe. So this week on Just Try This, I would like to just suggest that you do something that would give you a sense of awe, something that says like, wow, that's really something. And I think our levels of the thresholds for awe is really different for all of us. For Caroline Paul, it's a pretty high bar. For me, it's a little less. But I think having that sort of child sense of wonder as we go out into the world and see something that would inspire awe. Maybe it's just the clouds. Maybe it's a landscape. Maybe it's some kid doing something that's just unimaginable. Let's seek out and keep an open mind to those things that can enrich our lives with a sense of awe. I think that word awesome gets used way too much. And let's get to the root of it, which is awe. So what can you do this week to bring a little bit of awe into your life? That's Just Try this week. Thank you all for joining us on the show this week. If you liked the show, and I hope you did, this is the moment in the show where we ask something from you. Could you leave us a rating? Could you leave us a comment wherever you're listening to this? You're listening on iTunes or Spotify. These sort of things really help us. The only way anybody knows about the Super Age Podcast is from people like you suggesting it. So if you know somebody who you think would be interested in what Caroline Paul has to say, maybe say, hey, check out this podcast. Maybe you want to subscribe to it. That's my ask for the week. Everyone, I wish you all an awe-filled week, and we'll see you next week with another great show. Take care now.